Welcome to But For Real, a variety show podcast co-hosted by two therapists who also happen to be loudmouth feminists. I'm Valerie, your resident elder millennial child-free cat lady.
And I'm Emerson, your resident chronically online Gen Z brat. And on the show, we'll serve up a new episode every other week that will take you on a wild ride through the cultural zeitgeist, mental health, and beyond.
You'll definitely laugh and TBH sometimes maybe cry a little because this is a silly and serious show.
Buckle up, my friends, and let's get into today's episode.
Well, hello, listeners.
Cut to the chat of us being like, we are survivors because we're just the drama. So Val, tell us what's going on this morning.
Well, a couple of things, Emerson. We're both coming in at maybe 40% brain power.
Combined. So that's scary.
We did not, either of us, sleep particularly well or enough. And yet we persevere. And the other thing is that we hit a podcast milestone known as The Audio Was Not On. So we are recording this episode for the second time. Luckily, the first time was not this morning. We would have just given up. But yeah, we recorded it about a week ago and then realized a few days ago, like, well, somehow the mic was not there. So here's round two, you guys. We'll see how this goes.
You know, like we were saying, the energy might be kind of low, but I trust Valerie and I to be crazy regardless. So I think it's going to be interesting. So yes. Segueing over, and maybe I have to think of my different answer for the intro, you know, hence the whole topic. I love the word hence. It just feels hence. So when was the last time you think you got just a little dysregulated? How did you help yourself? And just remind yourself that it's normal as fuck, girl.
Well, I feel like other than whatever mental dysregulation, cognitive dysregulation is happening right now. Funny enough, my answer to this is very close to the answer that I gave last time. But it was last night because we were watching a movie that I'm going to tell you more about in a minute. And it's like one of my kryptonites is when really bad things happen to vulnerable people or animals. Even though I know it's fictional, I like to be present when like I'm watching something with, you know, my husband or whatever. And so like, well, you know, we'll have the phone put up. But if something is going on like that, I like have difficulty tolerating it. So I start picking up my phone and I'm like, I'm not going to pay attention to this part. And I literally was saying out loud, it's fictional. It's fictional. They're not real. This is fake. So yeah, that's how I took care of myself in that moment. What about you?
Mine also was yesterday. I'm like, okay, so the vibes were there. I got an IUD right after Roe v. Wade was overturned a couple of years ago. So it's been awesome in the sense that I'm like a menstrual cycle. Don't know her anymore. We've broken up for this amount of time. And I don't know if I just got like an extra spicy day, but for the first time in a long time, I was getting cramps and just kind of was like, oh, I think I'm on my period. And it's always a bit mind-boggling because I don't know. But I just was I was as tender as who knows what yesterday, honey. I felt like I just had little spikes all over me. And I was like, And I feel like as many femme or AFAB people do when you're menstruating, you're like, what's wrong with me? And then you're like, oh, like, it's my hormonal changes that I have no control over. Awesome. So I think once I kind of put that two and two together, I typically could have gone down an avenue of, is there something wrong with my IUD? There's not. It's going to last. Mm-hmm. I got a few more years left in me. We're good. I'm just putting it up to like, yeah, it's one of those like odd little things. And if there's anything serious, okay, well, I'll just keep an eye on it. There's not. So I spent a lot of time out in the cold, just doing some tapping. I was just kind of like looking around. I was tickling my vagus nerve and it was fine. I ended up having a really lovely dinner with friends. So it just shows that you can totally work through your things and just be normal about it.
And I love that like our examples show kind of the full spectrum of in my moment, of course, it wasn't like a real serious scenario, but the feelings were real. And I chose to disconnect. I chose to distract from those feelings. And you were like, you know what? I'm going to try to shift my state by going outside, yep. So it's like all of these are options, right?
Oh, yes.
Now it's time for our first segment, Tea and Crumpets, where we tell you what we can't stop talking about this week.
So the movie that I was alluding to, which I feel like is tea just because I wouldn't say that I loved it, but it was so interesting because it's one of those that after watching it, I was like all over the Rotten Tomatoes. Like, I have to see what all these reviewers are saying because my brain does not know how to make sense of what I just saw. So it's called Eddington. It came out like last summer, I guess. So it's now streaming on HBO. And it's by Ari Aster. And I don't know that I've seen any of his films, but he did Midsommar, which is still on my list. And I think he's just sort of known for making these films that are like very complex and deeply unnerving, which was the case with this. The cast was insane. The main two were Joaquin Phoenix and Pedro Pascal. So,
oh my God.
I know, right?
Whoa.
And yeah, it's set in 2020. And so it's like the kind of COVID meets BLM era. And it was sort of wild just seeing like the movie was like kind of all over the place, super ambitious, but it's like, oh no, but that makes sense because we were actually dealing with all of that simultaneously. So that feeling of it being chaotic makes a lot of sense. And then briefly, I just wanted to plug this guy that I discovered through a reel, I think the other day. His name is Dean Withers, and he's like a 21-year-old political commentator little guy. And he does streaming on YouTube and I forget which social, if it's TikTok. He's got like 5 million on TikTok, 3 million on Instagram, but he is sharp. It's kind of felt like, because I've heard, you know, Charlie Kirk, I heard him debate and stuff, and I was like, I may disagree with this man about pretty much everything, but he is damn good at debating. And we need somebody like that.
Right.
And this guy, I'm like, oh, damn, this might be him. So I am excited to check out more of his content.
Ooh, I'm excited. I want to go check him out.
Yeah, what's your tea?
Okay, so I threw down my car wash membership, but I was like, okay, like I'd love talking about that. And it is true. But I am inspired by hearing you talk about a movie. I did watch a movie yesterday, which is very rare for me, everyone. I'm like not a movie buff. I'm trying so hard. I don't know what it is, but most of it's like, I can't watch stuff till everyone's bored with it. And then I'm like, yay, now it's my turn. Hey, maybe that's PDA. Yeah,
I feel that.
Have you ever watched the Now You See Me movies, like about the magicians or whatever?
No.
Okay, I feel like you would like them. Pretty star-studded cast, too. Like James Franco, Woody Harrelson, Isla Fisher, Jesse Steinberg? Eisenberg.
Yeah.
I was like, there's a Berg in there.
Yeah.
This is the third one. And they're like this interesting group of magicians, mentalists. There's like some hypnosis. Like Woody Harrelson is like the hypnotist, which is so fucking funny. But they're essentially like these Robin Hood types where they're using a lot of the art of distraction and being magicians to help fight crimes, essentially, like
manipulating for good.
Yes. So I think you would fucking love it. And it's very like lighthearted and fun to watch. And it's like fun for the little twists here and there. Mm. So I just watched the third one. And it's interesting to kind of see them setting up like the next generation of the four horsemen is what they call them, which is so funny for the Gottman method folks out there. But yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. And I don't know, I have the inclination, I hear you of like, okay, I'm going to pick up my phone, you know, in that because I'm trying to deal with what's there. I'm just picking that up because I'm addicted to this shit anyways. So I'm trying to just like completely leave it and be long form content.
Yes.
Had a time.
The long form time. Content. Yes.
We need it. I'm trying to do more of it because we're all fried up here.
Now it's time for Step Into My Office, where you get advice from your favorite professionally qualified, personally peculiar therapist.
This week, our listener says, "Hi, Val and M. I've been in therapy for a few years now, and I feel as though I've done a ton of nervous system-based work. I genuinely understand my patterns so much better than I used to, and I can tell I've grown so much interpersonally. But here's the thing. I still get dysregulated, and it makes me super frustrated. I have moments where my anxiety spikes, I shut down in conflict, or I feel emotionally overwhelmed out of nowhere. And when that happens, I immediately think, why is this still happening? Or am I doing something wrong? It feels confusing because I thought the goal of this work was to be calmer, more regulated, and less reactive overall. So when I do get activated, it almost feels like proof that I haven't actually healed or that I've, quote, failed at therapy somehow. I guess my question is, if I've done all this work and I still get dysregulated, does that mean it's not working? Or is this just what being a human looks like? Sincerely, a dysregulated diva. What's your thoughts there for our diva?
Yeah, as per usual, it's like the answer is yes and.
Oh,
yes,
yeah.
It's normal and. I guess my first thought is like, and we've talked about before how, especially if you're trying to assess, okay, is this therapy a fit for me? Is this quote unquote helping? Is this therapist or this sort of approach working for me? That, yeah, I do think it's reasonable to expect that you should experience some shifts in your life. When you are putting in the work, you're investing your time, your energy, your money, et cetera. Yeah, you should feel like you have some tangible, I don't know, progress or evidence that like things are feeling a little different. I can show up to these situations a little differently. That being said, the and is that I really get frustrated by the messages out there. And this is especially big. And I feel like the online coaching world where it's like, rewire your subconscious once and for all, and you will be a new person. And it's just like, yeah, it kind of feels like the message is like, do the real work, do the deepest shadow work, and you will not even recognize yourself. You'll never get activated again. And I'm like, okay.
I'm like, yes, the fuck you will.
Yeah.
I'm really glad you brought that perspective up because I think how we can see that in the coaching world and of course, the pop culture element to this podcast, which we're both so ingrained in and love and are in as people and therapists, where I'm scrolling the interwebs and I'm seeing some of that content. And there are times where I'm like, am I doing the real work? And then I'm like, bitch, shut up. Yes. Yes, you are. And I don't know, the real work of never being dysregulated ever again is just simply so not true. And why I think we have so many interesting cultural interpretations of what it means to have emotional regulation, emotional intelligence. I was just joking with someone the other day that in the third season of Secret Lives of Mormon Wives, there was like an accountability word tracker where all of them were like, accountability, accountability, accountability. Like they loved that word. And it was just really funny to me because one of them was like, I think, can we actually look up that word? Because I think we're saying it all the time. And I just died laughing at how absurd it was because that's how culturally we treat things. We get all up here with what things are or what they're supposed to be. And we all get very attached to the meaning that we put on these things, of course. And I think so much of that goes into, you know, being regulated, where we have this very probably Western white understanding of what it means to be regulated and to have emotional intelligence and all of that. And it's just so not what that actually means most of the time, if that makes sense. I'm like, we're just getting lost in what the actual translation. So that's one part of it. And then yes, how that makes us all feel like shit when we're doing a ton of work. And then you have a very normal day where you get your period and you're just like a little bit off that day. I always talk to clients about the overprescription of I'm a sad person. I want to be a happy person. And again, that like where we find ourselves like in these very tight boxes where I don't know if I believe in happy people and sad people. I think I believe in people being people and shifting from happy and sad and frustrated and a magnitude of different states. And that's normal. So more to come, of course, for this episode today, but just a lot of binary thinking when it comes to emotions and why I thought, let's parse some of this out for the culture this morning, shall we?
Mm, Yes, amen. And take a shot every time you're scrolling through your Instagram feed and it's nervous systemness and regulationness.
Babe, we love the word cortisol. We love just like using the word somatic for things that I just don't think are somatic. I'm like, my stomach would be getting pumped, I fear.
Yeah. Maybe when we get a shot of kombucha. There we go.
And now it's time for the DSM. In our DSM, all varieties of dysfunction, spiraling, and meltdowns are welcome. In this segment, we break down complicated concepts and common misconceptions about mental health, well-being, and tell you what we really think.
So the real tea of our emotions, what it actually means to be emotionally regulated, and we'll get into some tangible takeaways and regulation skills that you can put into practice, put into your little toolbox, starting with what emotions actually are. We're often taught, of course, that emotions are, you know, the less rational side of being human. So irrational or disruptive, excessive, that really we should get control of our emotions. You know, emotion regulation means that we should just get them in check, right? And that if we don't, if we fail to do that, that it's immature if our emotions are too strong or too big. So calm is viewed as good. Intense emotions is viewed as bad, and that emotional expression is seen as just a lack of regulation. So that really like creates this dichotomy of logic and emotion, right? And what I love about like looking at emotions in this other way as energy in motion, right? This is charge moving through your body, that they are fast. And they are just responses of our autonomic nervous system, right? Our emotions are designed to help us detect safety or threat, to help us prioritize our needs, to notice our desires, to mobilize into action, and of course, to communicate both internally and socially. So if we look at it this way, then our emotions aren't necessarily instructions, because we're going to get into that more about like, we're not saying that just because you're feeling something, that like that is the truth and that is the, you know, path that you should take. But they are information, right? It's telling me something, even if it's not a direct, literal, like this emotion means blank. It's information. It's temporary, right? Not a permanent state. So it's that metaphor of, you know, you are the sky and your emotions are the weather passing through. It is contextual. So it's not about, again, this idea of like, this is just how I am as a person. I'm just sad. Obviously, we, you know, might have some trait tendencies, but that does not mean that you can't also express the full spectrum of emotion. So it is possible when you look at emotions in this more sort of fluid way, energy and motion, that we can feel anger without being aggressive. We can feel anxiety without just defaulting to avoidance. We can feel sad without collapsing and fear without always going into freeze. The other thing that I think is really important, again, this goes along with their information, not instructions, is that while sometimes emotion does come first, because it's that, again, it's that automatic nervous system response before we even have a conscious thought, other times emotions show up because of what we are thinking, what we might be ruminating or looping on. And of course, we know that, and we could do probably a whole episode just about thoughts.
Yes.
That our thoughts are often distorted. And that, you know, is just the human condition for a number of reasons, right? It's whether it's survival based or it's kind of like a thought is coming from a core belief that came from an early life experience where your brain generalized that experience to learn X about me or the world. And so based on that belief, I'm now ruminating, you know, this is how I'm interpreting this situation. And then based on that thought that I'm ruminating, this is now the anxiety or shame or whatever that I'm feeling. Of course, on the thought side, we need to, and again, maybe we'll do a whole episode on that, but don't believe every stupid thing you think. And don't conflate the idea that like emotions are valid with your emotions are telling you the truth about this situation, because it's valid that you are feeling that. And like, let's say that whatever it is, maybe it brought up some kind of inadequacy, shame stuff. Mm-hmm. It's valid that you are feeling that and that wow, this is a painful moment and I'm not wrong for feeling this. However, your thoughts that created that feeling might not be accurate. And that's important.
I was just telling a client, we were talking this week about marriage, and she was like, I just feel like all of these thoughts have just entered my mind so quickly. And I sat there in true Emerson fashion and I was like, yeah, you know, those cicadas that buried themselves under the ground for 20 years and caused havoc on Nashville and the surrounding areas, they just wiggled their way up to your head and now they're buzzing around, hitting against your windshield, dying and being like, what about this evil thing? And the cicadas aren't evil. They're just kind of freaky looking. And I was kind of scared when they were flying at me all the time. And they're just going to be flying. And yeah, sometimes we get these thoughts that have been burrowed, like Val's saying, how they tickle onto those beliefs. And you're trying to make sense of those. And the cicadas did what they needed to do at some point. They gone. So I don't know where they went, but I'm like, okay, I made my peace with you. So
see you in another 7 years.
Babe, bye. And I hope that I don't, you know, that was too much. So looking at the like pathology, why emotions get pathologized in our culture. So again, like Valerie was already talking about, emotions become labeled in that too much category when they're making other people uncomfortable or they're disrupting a kind of realm of productivity. And I don't mean just like in the workplace. I have been in situations with people where we've said, well, this just isn't productive right now. And like, okay. And just like an interesting word that we tack on when it comes to, again, those autonomic nervous system responses that everybody has. We tie it in a word to productivity, which is just interesting. So that's an important component. It's also important when they're challenging power or norms. If we look at it on that kind of cultural realm, I never stop talking about the angry Black woman stereotype and just how damaging it is when we group certain people together. And as much as I struggle, but like in the way that like we can group men together about certain things. And again, this isn't to not say that there are maybe genuine struggles and challenges with certain folks when it comes to what this means. And just like the intense labeling that happens, that just can be very damaging for norms and certain groups of people and how we interact with one another. And also the pathology is there when, like Valerie was saying, when they're not resolved quickly. We want it to kind of be up and over that hump and back to this kind of regulated, my court is whatever. And it's like, hey, like this shit isn't so cut and dry. In fact, I believe that some of it has to be messy and that there's nothing wrong with that. So again, the problem isn't the emotion, but we're looking at the context in which it shows up. Of course, we have a psych degree, so I wanted us to talk a little bit about how this all shows up in the DSM. I feel that Valerie and I, in our combined practice, have our foot on the neck of the DSM. We're like, yes, and we're like, let's talk about this. Because again, it's so interesting to me that in the realm of social media or, you know, quote, laymans that are outside of the mental health industry, a lot of people are like the DSM. And I feel like there was a time when nobody knew what the fuck the DSM was or was calling on that. Shout out TikTok, right? Shout out to our first ever episode, Val, but TikTok is not the DSM. So the DSM does not diagnose emotions. That is looking at diagnosing patterns of distress and impairment over time. So emotional intensity does not equate diagnosis. So we're looking at that appearing as a feature in conditions such as PTSD or trauma-related disorders. So we're looking at that nervous system stuck in survival mode, looking at that hyperarousal shutdown, more to come on hyperarousal and hypoarousal, but that emotional flooding where whew, that state just completely shows up, again, for these folks that have had pretty significant trauma history. So we're looking at specific triggers that are tied into traumatic memories or experiences and that excessive fight or flight that's impacting how these folks move through their lives day to day. Anxiety disorders. So that heightened threat detection. I'm walking through the woods and then I'm like, am I being hunted for sport? No, actually put me as the poster child for an anxiety disorder. I'm ready, DSM. And then, yes, the difficulty returning back to that baseline, or having even the consistency of what a baseline is, again, if we're operating quite often on that fight or flight. Mood disorders, of course. So we're looking at the intensity and the duration of emotional experiences more than the emotion itself. This ties into, I wanted to throw BPD, borderline personality disorder, down, because this is just having a really interesting cultural moment. I'm noticing personally and clinically, I've never in my life had so many people come in and say, do I have BPD? And I'm like, no, get off TikTok, please. So you don't. They're like, is Emerson like invalidating during session?
Right,
no,
right.
I love my people so much. But I'm like, no, you don't have BPD. That's a very specific criteria that we're looking at. So for BPD, we're looking at core difficulty with emotional regulation due to real or perceived threats of abandonment. We're looking at very core wounds here for a lot of these folks. And I just wanted to throw this down because I'm seeing this kind of cultural resurgence in, oh, she's so OCD. Oh, he's so bipolar, how we talk about people. Now I'm seeing, yeah, she's just fucking BPD. Whoa.
She's we so don't borderline. Even
know. She's so borderline. Okay, so first off, explain to me the criteria then and what that means if we want to start throwing that around. I'm about to start being that bitch at the dinner table. I'm like,
bringing the criteria.
I'm literally like this. So good morning, everyone. Here's my DSM.
Bringing the DSM to the dinner party. That sucks.
What a mood killer. So I just wanted to have that like very critical DSM reality check. And of course, the pop culture check here. So remembering that it's the patterns and why they exist. The DSM, again, with my thumb and foot on its neck, does not account well for chronic stress, capitalism, trauma that overlaps with neurodiversity and comorbidity, and the systemic oppression, the like white man patriarchal pieces that go into what it means to be regulated. Future episode on like the weaponization of stoicism. You know, Valerie, when we filmed this before, you brought that up, and I thought that was so just so on the nose with, you know, everyone expects this stoicism, but it's not actually what stoicism really means or what it's about. It's just this weaponized part where you're just cold and alexithymic or whatever, and it's just not about feeling. So again, the DSM can be naming those patterns, but it can't tell you whether your nervous system learned those patterns to survive and what we have to do with that survival mechanism inside of you.
Yes. Everyone get ready to take a shot of your kombucha, because we're going to talk about what emotion regulation actually means. And it does not mean that you're necessarily just like calm and cool as a cucumber, right? It means that you can feel the feeling, feel the emotion, stay within a range that feels sort of tolerable, manageable, like your wise adult is staying in the driver's seat. So you're retaining choice about how you respond instead of just like, here's a feeling, reaction, right? And we've all been there, right? Where we are more in that reaction mode. So again, we're not saying that we're going to reach a point where that never happens, but we can expand what's called the window of tolerance, which a lot of y'all listening probably know about, but basically it's this zone. Imagine sort of the bell curve, and you know that that middle chunk there is when you're in your window of tolerance. So when you're above it, you're in hyper arousal, where think of the gas pedal is pressed down, you're anxious, you might be panicky, you might be angry, flaring, rage, maybe there's urgency, any combination of those things. Or when you're underneath that window, you're in hypo arousal. So you might feel numb, shut down, dissociated, that kind of freeze state. Of course, it can be a mind fuck too, when it feels like the gas pedal and brake pedal are pushed at the same time and you're in that sort of like hyper arousal freeze. The idea that we can expand that window, and that certain life experiences, you know, complex trauma, chronic stress, all those things can shrink our window. And we don't expand it by jumping way outside of it and trying to do a 10 out of 10 thing that feels really, really hard and impossible. We expand it a little bit at a time through healing and through kind of pushing that edge just a little bit. It's really interesting too, because I don't know if you've seen any of this content, but I have been getting, and maybe it's from the last time we recorded this, my phone's listening, but I've been getting these posts in my feed about like why the window of tolerance is bullshit and like I'm not thinking of the right words, but it's like, oh, well, this is just cis heteropatriarchy and telling us that we need to tolerate things. And I'm like, not everything has to be a problem.
Like, no, like, shut up.
I know. I'm like, and that's like what bothers me so much about the algorithm and the content of it all is that for people to keep getting eyeballs and views and likes, we know that they're giving these sort of contrarian perspectives and hot takes so that it feels shareable and new and like exciting. And I'm just like, but then what happens is we shit all over ideas that are actually quite useful and pretty good, but just because they're popular or mainstream, like we have to push on them. And you know, I'm all for pushing on mainstream, like more broadly. It means every little idea is under assault just because we need to come up with some hot take against it. So window of tolerance is now under attack, you guys.
Oh, yeah. That is interesting that news for me to have.
I'm like, shut up.
That's so dumb.
And like, you know, obviously we're not saying that the people who are creating those posts are stupid. Oh, to me, it's a larger symptom of the fucking content game. Okay. Anyway, so common myths about the window. Again, like if I go above or below it, oh, I failed at my nervous system regulation. Or that if you're going outside your window that, you know, you just haven't done enough work on yourself. I should be able to control this by now. When in reality, most of us are moving in and out of that window like on a pretty regular basis. Obviously, you know, we talked about how certain life experiences can shrink the window and then you've got to kind of do some of that healing and skill building work to expand it. And those skills actually help you return to your window rather than prevent that activation ever happening. So when we talk about emotion regulation skills, we're not saying that the goal is to eliminate those emotions and achieve this perfectly regulated robot state. It's to be able to stay with the emotions in a way that feels safe and manageable. You're still swimming rather than getting completely pulled into the tide or the current. And I think one important note before we get into the skills is there is value in both, right? If we're sort of holding in one hand the value of shifting our state when we feel dysregulated, super valuable, right? Again, whether that means I'm going to shift my state by turning away from this distressing scene right now and going to my phone, or I'm going to shift my state by going for a walk outside, or I'm going to shift my state by doing some tapping. And on the other hand, we're holding this idea of being with, that we actually don't always need to quote unquote fix it when we may be feeling dysregulated or we're like in the emotion of it. It doesn't mean that you have to quote unquote fix that and I must get back into my window ASAP. It's just there's value in both. And so we're kind of talking about like, okay, when we do want to shift our state, what are some ways that we can do that?
Of course, we want to give you those tangible, some takeaways. This list I also wanted to throw down is not exhaustive. Like, my personal idea of regulation and coping skills, that list is long, baby girls and boys and days and everyone in between, because we just need a lot of shit to help us navigate modern times. So I wanted to just throw down some like easily digestible ones, ones that you could start applying at any point. And so I thought it was important to ground this in DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy. Mwah. Again, just super applicable for anyone. So the first one to bring up is urge surfing. You're on that little surfboard, baby. An urge is a wave, not a command. So again, thinking of those little brain cicadas. Okay, if they're just all around, or okay, here's this thing that I really want to hop on and make a story about. Can I notice the urge? Could I name it? Could I observe some of the sensations that's happening? Because I don't have to act on it to make it go away. I can just, that's part of that being with. So if I can observe the sensations, if I can just kind of observe from a place of non-judgment what's happening, then maybe I'm able to ride the wave and then I'm able to let it pass. So we're looking at the body experiencing that intensity without feeling like we have to go into straight up collapse, which is so important. And again, applicable for so many emotional states. So another big one is our distress tolerance, not suppression. So, you know, we're looking at those temporary strategies when emotions are intense. The goal is survival without self-destruction. So we're just keeping with that presence, like Val has been mentioning. So the one that I use the most from this and talk to clients the most about is TIP, T-I-P-P. So we're looking at shifting the temperature. Can I go put my hands under cold water? Can I go take a cold shower? Do a whole cold plunge if you want, babe, be my guest. Just even getting some cold, fresh air on your face, just shifting some kind of temperature with where you are. Engaging in some intense exercise, jog on the spot or do some jumping jacks or just kind of start walking and doing a nice little pace around. Just kind of shifting that physiological state, upping your heartbeat a little bit, just offers you something different. Some paced breathing. This is when we bring in our little box breathing in those counts of fours, or any other kind of focus on shifting the breath from very shallow in the chest down into the diaphragm. Anything Nadi Shodhana or alternate nostril breathing is one that I love to tell people to use during TIP. And then muscle relaxation. So again, you can pair this with breathing, but what is it like to notice that tension in my shoulders and then to bring it back down? I love mindfulness. I told Val, I was like, should I become a mindfulness facilitator this year? Like, I'm just feeling so passionate about it. So that's the little sequence for TIP. You can just write that down, that TIP anywhere, put it on a post-it note, almost at a postcard. Write yourself a postcard and then mail it and then open it. Yes, so we're just looking at any of those opportunities for grounding or sensory input or movement. Again, helping you when you want to shift that emotional state, knowing that you have options, knowing that there is a bit of a template for you to follow, which can be helpful. This is a pretty, feels basic, but is so powerful in the right, not in the right, but in certain moments, is just straight up emotion naming. So naming our emotions helps recruit the thinking brain or our logic brain. You'll often see with DBT, we have our logic mind, our emotional mind, and then wise mind is the kind of Venn diagram in the middle. So naming our emotions does help reduce that overwhelm because we are able to lean into that logic brain a little bit. And it can then kind of help us increase choice, which so many of us feel so encumbered by when we're having large emotional states, because it feels like choice is out the window because those cicadas are very loud.
I'll give an example of that one real quick.
I would love to hear it.
Yeah. So this is one that has been really helpful in conflict when I get activated, like with my husband, for instance, which is usually over some stupid shit, right? But it's like, it doesn't have to be over something important because it's whatever, you know, story is getting activated in our mind. So either like naming the story, like the story I'm telling myself right now is you think I'm stupid or whatever, or just naming, I'm feeling really defensive right now. I'm feeling that helps me to kind of pause and slow that down as opposed to just boom, jumping right into that defensiveness.
I love that. I think I totally probably got that from you for couples. And seeing that in my couples work has changed some of my couples. And again, yeah, the story I'm telling myself is powerful. Opposite action is one that I see a lot on the internet that I think gets pretty misconstrued. So opposite action feels like fake positivity. Oh, I have a clients that are like, oh, so I'm so angry. And then you want me to just start farting rainbows and like pretending everything's okay. Babe, no. But this is when we're looking at emotions, perhaps being out of proportion to the situation. Opposite action is very grounded in that large intensity. So it's requiring discernment. We're not utilizing this as an opportunity to just bypass or, again, flip that on this kind of toxic positivity. Thank you. Toxic positivity. Holy crap. It's not just about trying to flip it, you know, so immediately. And I don't know, opposite action is really challenging for me. And then the times that I've done it, I've been like, damn it, this did work. Now, will it work every time? No, but that's okay.
Yeah. Can you give an example of what opposite action would look like?
Yes. I'm trying to even think of a recent, either in clients or myself, with an emotional state. I think we were looking at, it was like a state of like like deep sadness. Mm. And so for opposite action, for this one case that I was in, we were talking through, was just like the deep sadness that leads into a path of ideating, suicidal ideation. Mm. And that very intense feeling that was very scary to this person that I was talking with about it. And they were able to say, okay, I was thinking about opposite action in that moment, and bless them, they were just throwing skills and skills and skills at this. And for some reason, opposite action was the one that stuck, where they thought, okay, if I'm leaning into such this sadness, and this isn't for everyone, but they thought, I could feel myself being so stuck in that loop and being caught in my own story. And so I decided to get up and go ask my roommate if they needed anything.
Yeah.
It just was so interesting for me to hear them talking about that. They were like, I was just so wrapped up in my own shit in my head and feeling like, they were like, I just felt like the I this or me this or in my life this. And so I was just so, you know, bogged down by that pain and just like being in pain with myself. I decided to get up and go ask my roommate if they needed something. And the roommate was like, I actually just like want to go take a walk. I feel kind of weird today. Like, I was going to ask, do you want to come with me? And they were like, yeah. So they went on a walk together and like in a way completely helped shift that state. And, you know, this is just like one example of how this person wanted to use opposite action for themselves. But I just thought that was so, I just was so proud of them. And I thought, that's so cool. I want to know your thoughts too on what you've seen there.
I love that example. And I think part of what I love so much about opposite action, again, if we're not looking at it, not as like, oh, I'm just going to try to bullshit myself that this isn't what I'm experiencing, but more like we are doing a 180 pattern interrupt, right? We are going like, okay, so this is what I'm experiencing right now. What if I just flipped it on its head entirely?
Yep.
And even if that flip doesn't feel 100% authentic, you are giving your brain and your body a completely different experience, right? So if it's like, God, I feel like shit and I just want to rot in my bed. And there might be times where you kind of indulge that and it's fine. But if you're like, actually, I'm going to go sprint down my street for, you know, 5 minutes or whatever. I think it's just like kind of a way of like lovingly tricking your body and mind to have maybe a little bit of a different experience. And even if it only shifts your experience 10 degrees, like that's huge.
I'm like a little pill and some peanut butter for the dog. I'm like, yeah, we can do that for ourselves. And again, I totally hear when people say this doesn't feel accessible for me. Okay, maybe opposite action isn't the first tool that you pull out of the toolbox. That's okay. But I really love that framing of here's me just flipping this on this head and trying to offer myself something different. So, you know, any of those skills, of course, just a little bit of a somatic reality check. I want to round out talking about regulation skills with these are best practice when you are outside of crisis, when we're in that nice little state of the window of tolerance where you feel regulated or you just feel open. Maybe nothing is super pressing. Clients all the time will say, okay, but I tried this and it didn't work. Okay, but are you practicing and trying it outside of a crisis? Mm-hmm. And everyone kind of goes, oh yeah, oh, I should have known that. No, it's okay, because we don't talk about the importance of doing this across the magnitude of your emotional spectrum. So just a tidbit there. And just, of course, we're looking at utilizing things across the different states of the nervous system, but not as this mechanism to silence or shame your emotions. That's never what any of this is about. So our but for real, folks, emotional regulation was never meant to make you quieter or more palatable or easier. It was meant to help you stay present with your humanity. And being regulated doesn't always mean being calm. It just means having the capacity enough to feel and respond and remain in relationship with yourself and with others. So if you are dysregulated, you are not failing. You're responding to something that matters. And the work isn't to regulate yourself out of your feelings forever. To build the capacity to stay with them.
Yes, love it.
And now our musical segment. Now that's what I call
okay,
where Emerson and I each share a song with each other each week as representatives of our respective generations. We tell you a little bit about the song or artist, and then we press pause, we share the song with each other, and then we come back for our live reactions. And we're capturing it all on a Spotify playlist linked in the show notes for you.
What is your pick this week?
I've just been on a Megan Thee Stallion kick. There's just something about her that makes me feel like okay, I'm hot, I'm a girl, I'm here. There's so many good ones, but I chose Bigger in Texas. She released this in October of 2024. And from the Wikipedia page, I just thought this was so interesting. This song is considered Southern hip hop and slab, S-L-A-B, slow, loud, and banging. I just can't stop thinking about how cool that is. So the association with hip hop music and the culture of Houston, Texas. Megan is talking her shit, baby, about her wealth and success, liking herself as a woman in the rap industry. God forbid a girl likes herself, and not caring what others think about her. And I really, really respect her and want to keep leaning into her stuff. She had a tough time for a few years in the industry trying to release her music under the record label she initially signed with. And so it eventually led to this kind of large settlement and separation from them. But this pushed her into founding her own independent music and entertainment company, Hot Girl Productions. And she signed a distribution deal with Warner Music Group in 2024 so that she truly could be, as she says in the story, the youngest bitch owning her masters.
Ooh, get it. Okay, we're going to do a little listen here. Okay, so first of all, her style is impeccable.
Oh my God.
We got like 10 different hair looks in one video.
Yes. We're feeling inspired, Valerie and I. I'm like, okay, let's go do something with our hair.
Oh my God. And just like, I really love the... I love vintage stuff. So I'm like, even the car that she's got, like the video quality, you know, they do these like shots where it looks like it's, you know, shot in the 90s or whatever. Like, I love the aesthetic. And of course, it's, yeah, just like a super hype song.
It's hype. Like, I feel so good listening to her stuff. And she's just tea. I'm like, Meg, we love you, girl.
Yes. Please don't go to the dark side like Nikki.
I know, girl. I can't with her. That's maybe a whole other episode.
Right.
Go to the dark side.
Oh my God.
Okay. What do you have for us this week, Val?
Well, I have a little track called In My Room by Julia Wolf. And you know, I'm proud of myself when I choose anything that has come out since like 2010. And I only discovered this through my cousin Becca's friend, Katie, who recommended it. She thought I would like it. And she was correct. However, I will tell you that from the original experience of watching this video together, it's a little scary. It's a little frightening. So let's go a little. Okay. Share again. Okay. I have a hot take.
Go
ahead. White contacts should be illegal. That makes your whole eyes look white.
Valerie so disturbed. She's like, she's literally
hiding.
She's very disturbed by a white contact. No, I think her like puking that blood everywhere, I'm kind of like, oh my God. But I said to Val, I was like, this is the 20, like this is the Gen Z evanescence, you know, where we're just like,
truly.
Like, hey, I love it.
Yeah, she's got a great voice.
No, it's amaze.
And now for our last segment of the show, welcome to Fire Dumpster Phoenix. It is rough out there, y'all, and we need all the hope we can get. It's time to go dumpster diving for some positive news and rise from the leftover Happy Meal ashes together.
Babe, I'm sure y'all are in this news cycle. I'm sure you're gagging and shitting like the rest of us, so we've got to go find some gems out there. So, Valerie, what did you kind of scrounge up for us?
Yeah, this came from the Good News Network, and I'm always here for a restorative justice story. Yeah. And there's this program in Montana called Center for Restorative Youth Justice that has been really expanding in recent years, and they have a lot of good data to show the efficacy of their programs. So there was this town called Kalispell in Montana where they've been implementing this. And by 2023, the number of youth in this town getting out of school suspensions decreased. There was 82 that year compared to 5 years earlier, there were 200. And also the recidivism rate, so committing crimes again, dropped to 10% compared to over double that in a nearby county. So how this program works is they get referrals from the youth court probation officers, school administrators, and school resource officers that are made on behalf of a juvenile offender who's broken some sort of law. And then this organization does a conference with that youth, their parent or guardian, and then creates this custom plan for restorative justice that might look like a peer group discussion or a victim offender meeting or some other situation where that youth is given the forum to come back into relationship with their community instead of like, oh, we're just going to slap you on the wrist and suspend you. Obviously, we know school to prison pipeline, you know, when all we're doing is punitive and we're not helping people get on a good track, it's, you know, straight to the prison pipeline. And so this organization really believes that by limiting the overuse of those sort of exclusionary discipline that just takes people even further away from the path that is right for them by taking them out of school, this is a community-driven approach that can really help at-risk youth avoid getting behind in school and then just starting that whole cycle. So it's super inspiring.
That's so amazing.
Okay.
I had a little doggy story.
Because of course.
Yes. So this is also from the Good News Network, as is every single one of my submissions, because we're just locked in. But if you have been on TikTok, you may have seen just this very beautiful line of Buddhist monks on their peace walk. And if you haven't, then some more tidbits on that today. So on their opening 112-day peace walk in India, this group of Buddhist monks stumbled across a stray dog who took to them so much they decided to bring him in, named him Aloka, and he's literally leading them across their peace walk. So that has just gone super viral in so many ways because everyone's like, dog. We all love a dog. But he has just been such a part of their journey, which is so lovely. He was hit by a car and got sick, but the monks were like, okay. They loaded him up in the truck, took care of him. Yeah, they love him and he loves them so much. Even though he was like ill and like literally got hit by a fucking car, he jumped out and was still trying to walk with all of his buddies. And the monks just talk about how inspired they are by this little guy and that the relationship they've built together is so wholesome and amazing. So Aloka and the monks who live in Fort Worth, Texas, are now embarking on their journey of a 2,300 peace walk to Washington, D.C. So this is going to cover 10 states total, they hope, in 110 days. I pulled this from their Walk for Peace Instagram page. It's a journey filled with both known and unforeseen challenges, yet with hearts anchored in calmness and minds set firmly on their purpose, the monks move forward. Step by step, embodying peace, resilience, and unwavering determination on their sacred path toward the White House. I mean, I watch these videos and I get just like a chill in my spine, but like a flutter in my stomach. Like it feels very nuanced how I feel. I know that the times are tough for the fact that the monks are out walking for peace because the world is in such disarray in so many places. But if you are listening to this and the monks are passing through, please give them food, water, you know, take care of Aloka, say hi. The videos that I've seen of people, I could cry. I get so emotional with that stuff. But as they're walking through, people are holding up signs like for peace and people are just coming out and people are bowing and like letting these monks like pass through their towns. And it's just so amazing to watch. It's scary, but it's so amazing. And I have so much gratitude that I get to see this in my lifetime, even though I may not see them, but I'm getting to see it somehow. And that's like the pure positive power of the internet. They come through, say hi, go talk to them, go bring them some water and some food and go be peaceful, whatever, you know, that means for today. I think that's so important for all of us right now.
I love that because there's so many different ways to peacefully protest and resist and we're all finding our own way.
Indeed. Well, all right. That's all we have for this time. We'll catch you at the next one.
This has been another episode of But For Real, produced by Valerie Martin and Emerson Ryder and edited by Sean Conklin.
But For Real is a Gaia Center production. The Gaia Center offers individual, couples, and group therapy for clients across Tennessee and in person in our Nashville office, as well as coaching for clients worldwide. For show notes or to learn more about our work, visit GaiaCenter.co or find us on Instagram at the Gaia Center and at But For Real Pod.
But For Real is intended for education and entertainment and is not a substitute for mental health treatment.
Also, since we host this podcast primarily as humans rather than clinicians, we are not shy here about sharing our opinions on everything from snacks and movies to politicians and social issues.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode.
See you next time, bestie.